Hello and welcome to 10 by 9, where 9 people have up to 10 minutes each to tell a true story from their own life. I'm Paul Dorn, and this is the 10 by 9 podcast. I took 10 by 9 to Donegal for the first time in its history when we were invited to take part in the Francis Brown Literary Festival in Ballybuffet. And what a night it was. An intimate gathering at the wonderful Baylor Theatre with amazing stories on the theme, home.
Ye look like a good lassie. You'll help me find my wee Dougie. She'll be feared all by herself.
The house went in the market and we agreed to sail within 4 days. We packed the house within weeks and bought a one-way ticket to Ireland with no plan other than to live in Donegal.
The crowd was on its feet, everyone on the stage and off it was cheering. We clambered up the steps and there was Mum in her beautiful white gown, tears streaming down her face.
So, 3 brilliant storytellers, including 2 first-timers and an old hand. There's a tale of terror, a tale of seeking and finding, and a big showbiz finale. So, let's get going. And here's our first-timer. Meet Rosaline Callaghan.
Autumn wandered in, and I moved up to Primary 3 at Sacred Heart. Daddy had exchanged our old black and white for the coloured television, with a side slot for shillings the telly man would collect every Friday, perched peacock proud on a chest of drawers in our tenement parlour. On its first Thursday night at ours, the TV guide told Daddy that Calamity Jane was going to be on, and he told me I could stay up late to watch it. I was beside myself with excitement. We'd never seen a film in colour. I loved being the eldest on nights like this. I didn't love it so much when I had to go for the messages. After dinner, Daddy ordered me off to the corner shop. He wrote a list on a piece of paper. For his Citizen newspaper, Mammy's Capstan unfiltered cigarettes, a box of milk tray for the grand occasion, and a pennyworth of sweeties for me. He folded the note, tucked it into my school cardigan pocket, and counted out the coins into my hand. "Don't lose the change. Hang on to it tight. And don't drop the messages. Come straight home. You'll get a good scalp if you speak to strange men." "Here you go, lassie," Mrs. McDermott said as she helped me gather the messages into my arms and clutch the change. In the soft dusk, I sauntered home again, entered our close, and started the climb up 3 flights of piss-whiffing concrete stairs. On the second landing, a man blocked my way. "Have you seen a wee puppy hen?" He was a strange man. I didn't speak. "I can't find her. Please help me look for her." He was a strange man. I stayed silent. "Ye look like a good lassie. You'll help me find my wee Dougie. She'll be feared all by herself, and her mommy's greeting for her." "Don't speak to strange men and come straight home," collided with a scared lost puppy and her mommy crying for her. "I canna speak to strangers." "Sure, I'm not a stranger. We've made friends." "I dunno know where to look." "We'll start at the back. I'll carry you. It'll be quicker." He hefted me over a shoulder like our coal man hoisted a bag of slack from his horse and cart. His tweed jacket scoured my face as I hung over his back. It looked like Daddy Beck's tweed jacket, but smelt nothing like my grandfather's. This one was reeking. My school brogues flailed in the cold air of the close, frantic to find traction. If he takes me far, I'll be lost. I won't know how to get home again. I don't know what to do. The strange man isn't talking to me anymore. He's only carrying me. No one's told me what to do if a strange man wants to carry me. Daddy carries me. Granda Beck carries me. I've never been carried by a stranger. He needs me to help him find his lost doggy. The wee puppy is scared. Its mommy is crying for her. I'm trying to go straight home. The man won't let me. I've dropped the messages. I've lost the change. I'll get into bother. Money doesn't grow on trees. Daddy will be wanting his paper and mommy will be wanting her fags. I've dropped my sweeties. Calamity Jane will be on. I've missed the start. I don't know what to do. Let me down. Please let me down. I need to go home. Wheeze yourself. We need to find my wee puppy first. The man in the close took a step downwards, down another and another, towards a rancid gloaming and far awayness from home. I began to wriggle and squirm. His fingers dug into my back as he clenched my body to his. When he hurt me, my tummy somersaulted the way it did when I kicked the sky and went too high on the swings. I kicked at him, screaming as hard as I could, making sounds I'd never heard before in my life, yowling and howling and hurting my throat, desperate to get away, so desperately in need of getting home. My squeals scudded across the stairwell. A first floor door opened. Illumination from the O'Sullivan's hall encroached on the lightlessness of the landing below. The strange man tossed me onto the stairs, skedaddled. I scampered up past the scattered coppers and shopping, racing for refuge. I hammered on our door with a fist by thrusting my hand through the letterbox to hold it open to be sure my mommy and daddy heard me roaring, even though they'd be watching Calamity Jane. Let me in. Let me in quick. Daddy flung open the door, ashen-faced and flustered, to see me trembling and bawling my eyes out. What's wrong? Jesus Christ, Wayne, what's wrong? The man in the close tried to take me away. I lost the messages. Seizing my hand, he hauled a still sobbing me down to his car parked out the front and turfed me into the passenger seat. Fury devoured his daddiness. I'll kill the bastard. Crawling Cortina headlights scavenged through each bedimmed street of Bridgeton Cross. Keep your eyes peeled, Cutty. Is that him? No, Daddy. Is that him? No, Daddy. Is that him? No, Daddy. No, Daddy. No, Daddy. I never saw the man in the close again, but he had crucified insouciance. Wariness and watchfulness supplanted expectation of safety. I no longer cut my path through the world eyes front, but scanned, scoped, and scrutinized my landscape. I watched my back and interrogated my terrain out of the corner of my menace-stung eye. For I understood, interlopers would interrupt my trajectory because I was a girl walking.
Oh, Rosaline, thank you so much. What a terrifying experience, told so brilliantly. I hope you'll be back with more stories soon. As I remind you on every podcast, 10x9 is always on the lookout for storytellers, whether new like Rosaline or returning. So get in touch at 10x9.com. If you're a bit nervous, shy, or reluctant, remember you're the people 10x9 was created for. Okay, on to our second story, and it too came from a first-timer. Say hello to Elaine Bullock.
I was born to two parents who were raised by Belfast. They were 17 and 18 when the Troubles broke out. Needless to say, it left an imprint on our family so large that it impacted every single word and action afterwards. Dublin welcomed me into the world, where I lived until I was three. My family moved to England for work, where I would spend the next 38 years. Every year of my childhood, we'd return home to visit a plethora of relatives, including countless cousins. They would laugh at my odd accent, which was a tangled hybrid I struggled to control as it tumbled out of my mouth. I had no idea that other children didn't have an accent for home and an accent for the outside world. It's taken me my entire life to stumble across the life raft term code switching, belatedly learning that what I'd instinctively done all of my life, and that even more astonishingly, others did it too. I knew what I was, what I felt, like the letters boldly imprinted through the core of a stick of rock. But increasingly I realized that the people around me never saw the letters, never took the time to discover their existence. They glanced at the stick of rock from a bird's eye view, fleetingly taking in its colors and stripes, only checking they were pink. With the clipped plum tones I adopted with friends in England, they assumed I was like them. But as I grew older, I knew I wasn't. Of course, we shared the same social references, similar upbringings. The odd time I had friends to the house, my brain didn't know how to keep up or switch accents fast enough. And my words slopped about like paint spilling over the side of a can. My friends would ask why I was talking like that, or my mum would smile at me, bemused that this wasn't the usual accent I addressed her in. With my friends safely tucked away, I sighed in relief, slipping back into familiar syllables like an outgrown pair of bubbled pyjamas that should have already seen the charity shop. I was a hybrid. I hadn't grown up in Belfast, but I understood Northern Irish dark humour, the numerous sayings. I knew how to walk through Belfast to see family, keeping quiet when required, depending on the colour of the curbstones. I remember trips to the Botanic Gardens and the Ulster Museum, the army checking under our bus with their telescopic mirrors, and the turnstile checkpoint when we popped into town to look around the shops. I knew not to openly stare at the machine guns and to silently follow quiet conversations the adults had inside with doors and windows shut. I still recall meeting the smile of my mother when a noise from the window startled me. With confusion etched on my face, my mother's cool explanation of gunfire, two streets away, made me freeze. She chuckled, as if reassuring someone with a stubbed toe that the pain would soon subside after going through childbirth herself. The sucker punch followed. Best keep away from the windows just to be safe. But to my cousins and many who heard my accent, and still do, I wasn't from that place, didn't live in those streets, I'd never grown up there, and couldn't possibly understand or know what they'd been through, which was incontestably true. And so, I was an anomaly, a pariah, an outsider from a place that held my heart. It was my husband who introduced me to Donegal. His grandparents hailed from Carrigart and had a caravan up in Downings. I've been to Donegal many, many of the 23 years we've been together, and its magic has enchanted me until it became entangled with my very essence. In other relationships, you might hide the cost of a dress or a haircut costing a week's wages to keep the peace. My guilty secret that led to the hurried close of a laptop every time my husband entered the room was property searches in Donegal. The gardens, the view, the space, the peace and quiet. Yet everything you could ever need on your doorstep, including the world's most stunning beaches. And so, as COVID came and left its spectral shadow on us, like many, I concluded that life was too short to keep my dreams on the shelf like a photo album, pages gently stroked with a wistful smile. People said, sure, she hasn't a clue what she's doing, and that I was mad in the head. I chewed these phrases down like Popeye with his spinach. The house went in the market, and we agreed to sail within 4 days. We packed the house within weeks and bought a one-way ticket to Ireland, with no plan other than to live in Donegal. Three gorgeous children, a loved mongrel rescue dog, and a storage container full of 10 years of our lives, and not a notion of what was going to happen next. Neighbours and friends questioned my sanity, and I was met with frozen faces when I explained that what truly terrified me was the thought of another 10 years of mediocrity in suburban England, where I didn't belong. Finding my home in Donegal, in whatever form that took, was no hardship. The Irish are gold medal first class Olympians at the national pastime, discussing the weather. With 103 different words for rain in Gaelic, yes, I'm trying to learn, and a glimpse of every single season in a day, every day, it's no wonder. Donegalers are smart. My observations are that each person has signed an unwritten contract with nature. It's an inherent part of living in my new home. Work in line with the seasons. At this time of year, you strip the blackberries, collect firewood and coal for the stores, sort your pots and tidy the garden, bring everything indoors that you can, including the cattle. In winter, you echo what our ancient ancestors did. Binge on box sets in front of the fire while trying to keep the mice out. Come spring, you plan the garden and line up the outdoor jobs of fixing, mending, while enjoying the new arrivals of lambs in every field you walk past. If you aren't right in the head, like me, winter's denouement is announced through the ritual of taking to the water to enjoy the brazen kiss of the Atlantic, jellyfish-free. By summer, the cattle are out again, and the grass needs mowed daily, like a haunting 6 o'clock shadow. If you're lucky, you can squeeze in a summer barbecue under the protection of an umbrella, ready to start over again by Samhain. Within the first year of living here, our neighbours towed my brother out of a ditch, giving up their entire morning and diesel to boot. They refused to accept any kind of payment for their generous time and efforts, save the mirth and stories they carried with them to no doubt later tell to gales of laughter from their own friends and family. They've dropped eggs, milk and bread over the fence, as well as sweets for the children when we were stuck at home with COVID. I still don't know the names of some of my neighbours that I lived alongside for 10 years in England in the cul-de-sac that sat within the space of half an acre. I've come to realise home is a feeling that you consider your own truth. The tighter I clung to the need to belong to a place called home, the more I blew like a dandelion seed in the wind. And so the place where I grew up has now become my mum's house. I've chosen my home, Donegal, the forgotten county. The irony is not lost on me. Its wild ruggedness calls to the very core of me, ancient and primordial. Donegal is not just in my heart, it's stitched to the very fabric of my soul. The people here are generous, warm and laid back, but they're no dozers. These days I smile when the dance begins, the questions asked gently of where my accent's from. I'm an old lady now, and so I cut through the pleasantries with a simple response. I'm a mongrel. I no longer feel the need to justify myself because I found my home.
Elaine, that was wonderful. What a warm tribute to gorgeous Donegal. You must come and join us in the Black Box soon. Now, if you'd like to help ensure 10x9 and this podcast continues to go from strength to strength, you can help us out with a donation via Patreon. There's a link on our website, 10x9.com. As always, a big thank you to everyone who has given, whether electronically or at our live events over the years. It really helps, and we are so grateful. Okay, on to our third and final story of Home. He's been coming to 10x9 in Belfast for many years and is often featured on the podcast. But there was a very special reason for Jim Livingston to want to come to Donegal to tell his story.
I live in Belfast. It's my home. My mother, on the other hand, was born in Donegal. She was lucky because she had two homes. Belfast, and the place she always called her home, Ards, near Chrysla, County Donegal. She was born there in 1924, and she was christened Bridget Ina Gallagher. Years later, she became better known as the singer, Bridie Gallagher, the girl from Donegal. In a 50-year career, she sang in small halls and ballrooms across Ireland, the grandest theatres around the world, sold millions of records, and was described by the BBC as Ireland's first pop star. Her great friend Daniel O'Donnell said, "She paved the way for the rest of us in Irish show business." But what most people didn't know was the special pain that she suffered throughout her amazing career. That was the pain of being away from her children at home while she toured the world stages. And I think it's fair to point out that it affects all women and men in show business, where sadly success often means being away from home and their children too much. One evening in 1959, when I was just 7 years of age and my brother Peter was five, we were in the Metropolitan Theatre on the Edgware Road in London. It was packed with over 2,000 people. The stage was hidden by a big velvet red curtain. Suddenly the orchestra struck up a large, loud ta-da, and the announcer called out, "Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the London Metropolitan Theatre. In the fifth week of this record-breaking show, guaranteed to entertain all the family, ladies and gentlemen, please welcome the star of our show, the girl from Donegal, Miss Bridie Gallagher." The crowd roared and clapped excitedly as the curtain drew back, and there on the stage, framed in a bright spotlight, was our mum, Bridie, in a beautiful dress, as usual. Peter and I both jumped to our feet, clambering onto the backs of the seats in front of us to get a better view. We had seen her on stage before, of course, in Ireland, but this was London, and best of all, Mum didn't even know we were there. We had been flown from Belfast as a special surprise for her. She had been complaining to Dad for weeks about being away from home so much and missing her two wee boys. And then the theatre manager told Dad one night that she was to be presented with a golden key the following week to recognise the record-breaking run in the theatre. Apparently, the previous record holder for the continuous capacity audiences had been Mary Lloyd in 1910. Dad and the manager hatched a secret plan. Our Auntie Frances told us on the Thursday, "We're going to London on Saturday morning to see your mum as a special surprise." Well, we were over the moon. When we saw the plane, we gasped with amazement. We'd never seen one before. On the plane, the noise was horrendous, taking off and even when cruising at altitude. My brother Peter chortled with delight throughout. I, on the other hand, threw up at least four times into a sick bag that poor Auntie Frances had to hold to meet us. He grabbed us both and held us up high as we shouted with joy to see him, and soon we were in a car driving into the city. We gazed in wonder at the tall buildings, the beautiful bridges, the fancy cars and the crowded streets. At last we arrived at Sussex Gardens. This was just around the corner from the theatre on the Edgware Road and was where the show dancers all stayed in digs. We were to stay with them for our weekend visit while Mum was in her hotel nearby, unaware of our presence. Luckily, we knew a few of the dancers very well, like Vivian, Pat and Molly. They were from Belfast and we had seen them many times at our home. Some of the other girls were English, so we didn't know them, but that didn't stop them from hugging us, playing with sweets and fizzy drinks, and generally wanting to play with us constantly. For two young boys, this was quite a special treat. Surrounded by beautiful tall girls who wore a variety of exotic clothes, seemed to smoke incessantly, chattered and laughed loudly, and smelt of sweet perfume. Lucky boys. After a tea of fish and chips and ice cream, it was time to go to the theatre. Auntie Frances guided us into the back row of the stalls. We were gobsmacked at the size and beauty of this West End theatre. The show featured many performers we knew from back home, comedians, musicians, singers, magicians and dancers. But best of all, our mum Bridie. We cheered when she was on the stage at the end of the show and the curtains closed and then shortly opened again to signal the show finale, in which each of the performers came on one by one, bowed and took their applause. Finally, mum came on back on stage for her now customary standing ovation. Then, without warning, the theatre manager walked onto the stage. Mum was clearly surprised and probably wondered what was wrong. The manager took the microphone and announced to the audience and company that he had two surprises for Bridie. First, he presented her with a large golden key and bouquet of flowers to recognise the record-breaking business brought to the theatre. She was overcome with joy, and all the cast applauded while the audience cheered loudly. Then there was a hush as the manager said, "I have a second surprise for Miss Gallagher, and that is to tell you that this lady travels the world entertaining thousands of people every week. But I know that however much your applause means the world to her, ladies and gentlemen, there are two things even more important to her because she is a mother. Two little people back home, her young sons, Jim and Peter, who she has not seen for 4 weeks, and for whom I know she has been pining. Bridie, especially for you, we have flown your boys to be here tonight. Jim and Peter, please come up." Well, Peter and I ran up the aisle to the stage. The crowd was on its feet, everyone on the stage, and off it was cheering, shouting, clapping and crying. We clambered up the steps and there was Mum in her beautiful white gown, tears streaming down her face. She grabbed us both and held us close, while all around people cheered, clapped and cried some more. I think Peter and I were the only ones not crying. We were back at school 2 days later, exhausted but full of urgent news to share with school pals and teachers. In particular, I wanted to tell my mates about the dancing girls in London. They listened with gaping mouths. But Mum was still in London. Her tour would last a further 3 weeks, and then she'd be home for a week or two before flying off on another tour. Just over 50 years later, in January 2012, Mum had long retired from performing, although she stubbornly refused to announce her retirement. She never did. Her health had declined after a succession of strokes. She was frail and at the age of 87 was afflicted by early dementia. I tried to persuade her to move into a nursing home, but she was adamant. "I'm staying in my own home," albeit looked after by her family and a carer. Then one day she had to be taken to hospital after a fall at home. She had fractured her hip. After tests and x-rays, she was admitted to a ward. As she was being helped into bed on the ward, I was stopped in my tracks by a painting that I saw on the wall outside her room. I could not believe what I saw. It was a painting of Muckish Mountain, overlooking Sheephaven Bay and Ards near Creasla. It's where she was born. It was home to Mum. I was slightly traumatized by the picture. Was this an omen of what was to come? Sadly, a week later, Mum developed complications after surgery and passed away, with us at her bedside. And I'm glad to say peacefully. A few days later, after her funeral mass in Belfast, the cortege headed for Chrysla, where she was buried in the place she called home, where their hearts are like the mountains in the homes of Donegal.
Ah, Jim, thank you so much. Such a gorgeous love song to your mum and her legacy. And what a way to end the podcast. It was also, of course, a wonderful way to end our evening in Donegal, our first, but hopefully not our last. And that's it for this podcast. You can keep up with all our upcoming events and themes by having a look at our website, that's 10by9.com. While always free, some events might require tickets from the venues. 10by9 is on the socials, of course. Be sure to follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and or Instagram. And I promise not to flood your feed with nonsense, just information. Thanks to everyone who helped bring 10by9 to Ballybuffet. Everyone at the Francis Brown Literary Festival, especially Celine and Anne. Thanks too to the team at the Baylor Arts Centre, who looked after us brilliantly. And thanks to the Donegal audience, so supportive and warm. A massive thank you, of course, to all our storytellers. But the biggest thanks this week goes to Rosalind Callaghan, Elaine Bullock, and Jim Livingston. I'm Paul Dorn, and I'll be back with another podcast soon. But for now, bye-bye.